Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us for The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, May 30th. This morning, we hear more about the controversy over allowing commercial fishing in the Pacific Island Heritage Marine Reserve. Today, we hear from a scientist who argues that the move is short-sighted. We also learn more about gene editing research that's been underway here at the University of Hawaii. We heard from Nobel Prize winner and Hilo High graduate Jennifer Doudna yesterday. Today we catch up with a second Hilo High alum about his own work in gene editing on the cusp. Plus, we talk Hawaii's energy future, just coming off of an energy conference on Maui. How vulnerable are we? And heading into the summer, we talk more about fire prevention in Kula. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This month, Earth Justice filed a lawsuit to block President Trump from allowing commercial fishing in the Pacific Island Heritage Marine Reserve. We heard the take from the Western Pacific Fisheries Council and the concern for the future of the last remaining cannery in American Samoa. Today, we hear more about the science and the argument for not relaxing the protections in that area of the Pacific. Bob Richman is a coral scientist and head of the UH Kiwalo Laboratory, and he's worked in Guam, Samoa, and Palau and Hawaii for nearly 5 decades. He unpacks what's behind the science of protecting the reserve for the future.
The ocean is a shared resource, and we know that within the cultures of Hawaii and the Pacific. Nainoa Thompson, the navigator and the head of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, said it very eloquently, saying that the oceans connect the islands, they don't separate them. And that goes with the marine resources as well. For the fisheries that are targeted in this discussion of the marine monuments, these are, in fact, what are called pelagics, meaning open ocean, free-moving fish. And so for that reason, we look at the ocean as a shared resource. And there has been a very strong scientific consensus that about 30% of the ocean needs to be set aside in protection if we're going to leave a vital legacy for future generations. And that's one of the reasons I love working in the Pacific and I've been here for 45 years, is that the intergenerational element of leadership and of community that always goes into the decision-making process. I just got back from a week in Washington, D.C., and it was tragic. But beyond that, in 30, 35 years of trying to work at that bridge between science and policy, whenever I go to D.C., it's 2 years for the House of Representatives, 4 years executive branch, 6 years Senate. That's the time scale I'm always being asked to explain what will happen for 2 years, 4 years, 6 years. When I go to the Pacific Islands and I work with groups, whether it's American Samoa, where I've done a lot of work, or Guam or Palau, where I still work, it's what about our children and grandchildren? And that, as a scientist and as a parent, is really important to me. They're taking the long look at these resources as being an intergenerational responsibility and legacy issue for them. So the issue of these marine protected areas, there's an urgency involved, and the world's oceans are in decline. There's no question. Climate change, marine pollution, overfishing. Those are the three major stressors going on. We can't really control climate change right now quickly, but things were moving forward. We're looking at a bump in the road right now. But for the most part, most of the world's nations, and especially the Pacific Islands, are doing everything humanly possible to try to address the crisis of climate change, which is what I consider to be one of the existential crises for humanity right now. You look at anything from economy, the reason why everybody's property taxes, property insurance went way up this year, including ours, is because of the natural disasters, hurricanes, typhoons, flooding tied to climate change. And it's only going to be getting worse. So anyone who pretends it's not there is fooling themselves. But to the issue then of the overfishing, the ocean is a finite resource. People consider it that it's, you know, bottomless. It's not. And so the reality is, and as a scientist, I think the best way for me to explain it to people is that in an area like a marine protected area, it's really a bank account. And it's a bank account for today, but most importantly, it's an investment in a bank account for the future. Look at the fish as your principal. These are the things that produce interest, which is their reproduction. That's their offspring. When they spawn, when they produce the larval fish, So what we look for, there are 8 criteria we use for developing ideas of where these protected areas should go. So right now, out of the 30% that has been clearly identified as a scientifically sound mandate going forward, we're at less than 3%.
So this notion that we can relax some of the protections is very short-sighted.
Extremely short-sighted, but it's also economically insane. So the argument is that this is a great economic boon, and in fact, it's an economic failure. And the reason why I say that is when it comes to fisheries, especially the pelagics, we affectionately call it BFFs. We're not talking about best friends forever. We're talking about big fat females. The larger the female, the more eggs she can hold and the more offspring she can produce. You double the size of a female fish, and you can increase her egg capacity by hundreds to thousands fold. So the example I can give you is this bank account. What these marine protected areas do is they protect populations of fish in a density where spawning is successful because the way in which they reproduce is the male and female come close to each other. The females release their eggs into the water. The males release their sperm, and they're externally fertilized. They have to be in density. They have to be close together. You want those big females because they churn out tons of eggs. And again, that multiplier effect is amazing. So it's like me telling you, right, Catherine, if you put $100 in your bank account, I'll give you 5% interest. If you double that and put in $200, I'll give you 500% interest. You know, what fool would jump to say it's insane not to do that? So this concept is when you say, you know, make America's economy great again, this is actually undercutting the economy. And there are really good data that came out of a group at UH showing that when Papanaumokuakea, the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, was set aside as the expanded marine protected area under Obama from the 50 miles to the full 200, it's called spillover. It's basically the interest that's coming out of that bank account, Papanaumokuakea, that's now increased the fisheries catch along the edge there. And it's well known in fisheries. Every fishery knows it. It's called fishing the line. You go right up to the edge of the MPA and you can fish your brains out. And that's exactly what they do. And so to me, it's just a tragic misdirection and misinformation to be able to say that by opening up these areas to fishing, we're helping our economy, when in fact, it's like saying, okay, I'm going to give you a bank account. I'm going to give you as many checks as you want. And I'm not even going to give you a monthly statement to tell you what's in the account. They fired so many of the NOAA people from Habitat and Fisheries over the last couple of months that they have no way of tracking the fisheries anymore. So, I mean, to me, this is the ultimate in irresponsibility, poor planning, and it will, in fact, hurt everybody. Now, to the issue of the American Samoa area, you know, my heart goes out to them. I've been to American Samoa. I work with them. I have an active project with American Samoa Community College. We fund 9 scholarships a year there for students to get involved in the marine environmental sciences. So they have culturally connected people from American Samoa making these informed decisions. The problem there is that they went from 3 canneries to 2 canneries to 1 cannery. And had nothing to do with the Pacific Island Heritage Area, previously known as Pacific Rimwood Islands. It had everything to do with the economics of fisheries and catch, and it's cheaper to process them elsewhere. So it's unfortunate. Rick Gaffney would be the perfect person from the coalition to speak to it because he's truly an expert on fisheries. I'm more the science guy. But working with Rick and working with the others and reviewing the data, we know very clearly that it's not a matter of if that third cannery is going to close, it's a matter of when. And so the goal is to try to work with the people of American Samoa, the leadership, the governors, the community, to do everything we can to provide sustainable alternatives to that. To the focus on this particular issue, less than 1% of the fishing activity had been in these areas that are now, quote unquote, open. So this is not helping anybody. And it doesn't take long to fish something down fairly quickly. The areas that were chosen, and I think I can just summarize it in really 2 phrases. You know, if not there, where? And if not now, when? There is an urgency to be able to protect what's left over. I do a lot of work on coral reefs, as you know. When I started working on coral reefs 51 years ago, which is amazing because I'm only 39 years old. You figured the math
on
that?
Yes, I've known you for that time.
Exactly. And so when I started working on coral reefs back in 1974 in the Caribbean, most of the reefs I studied were at 70% coral cover. I went back to those same reefs that I studied as an undergraduate student 2 years ago, and most of them were under 5% and some of them were under 2%. These reefs are no longer capable of coming back on their own, so there's a great deal of interest and investment in coral reef restoration. Guam got hit big time with the coral bleaching events. So did other areas, Palau and American Samoa and others. But the good news is if there's a certain baseline stock left, then there is a chance for assisted recovery to occur. Same with fisheries. There's a certain amount that you need, a critical mass, in order to get going again. And so this is what we're concerned about, is with the continued degradation of the ocean from the stressors of climate change, overfishing, and marine pollution. We really have to be strategic in selecting those areas that have the greatest value to the region as well as to the individual islands. Because of climate change, there's this piling up of hot water in the Western Pacific. It actually has a formal name called the Western Pacific Warming Pool. And if you look at satellite imagery that's done with infrared, you can see this big red blob all the way out by Indonesia. Winds are pushing water from south of the equator and from the Eastern Pacific all the way to the west, and this warm water is piling up. And the result is it's forcing fish, especially big tuna, to get out of that area. So they're moving to the east, they're moving north and south of the equator. So what we're looking at when we decide, is this a good area or not for marine protected areas? Pacific Island Heritage Monument is the perfect location, as is Papanamokuakea. These are the catcher's mitts. As the fish are leaving the Western Pacific, and there's a reason for it physiologically, tuna are big. They get to be very large. They have a very large volume to surface area, and they burn a lot of oxygen because they can swim. And so that requires a lot of oxygen. As water temperatures goes up, the ability of the water to hold oxygen decreases. Warm water doesn't hold as much oxygen as cooler water. So the fish know that, and they're getting out of Dodge. They can't handle the warmer water in the Western Pacific, so they're moving to the east, north and south of the equator, and the Papanamokuakea Marine National Monument and the Pacific Island Heritage Monument are the perfect locations. These are the places where the fish are headed, and those are the areas that have the greatest ability to be these bank accounts that are able to collect this principal, let the females get to these large sizes where their reproductive output is exponentially larger than the smaller fish, and feed the rest of the Pacific, because there's currents that go back and forth. El Nino years are different than La Nina years, but it's not only an investment for American Samoa, it's an investment for Hawaii, it's an investment for the entire Pacific, that when we work together as an ocean and people are, you know, careful about how this is a shared resource with an intergenerational element to it, you couldn't do better than to protect the areas like Pacific Island Heritage Monument.
That was Bob Richmond, director of the University of Hawaii's Kiwalo Laboratory, who dropped by HPR yesterday to talk about the science behind the legal challenge to the executive order to relax restrictions around the marine protected areas and allow commercial fishing, which was closed off under the Biden administration. We'll have more of our conversation with him after a short break. Get back to Bob Richmond and a conversation we had about cuts to science. Richmond just returned from Washington and is headed to a UN Oceans Conference in France next week. Let's talk a little bit about the threat to science. You said you just got back from the nation's capital and it was not a good scene. The news this week is that Hawaii has joined a lawsuit to try and halt cuts to the National Science Foundation. But yeah, science is under attack.
Oh, it is. And again, it's just a total enigma to me. How in the world this is supposed to be a proactive view? Anyone knows economically, you know, I've been at the kind of science to policy interface for quite a while. And you have to be astute and you have to be strategic. And through all of the previous administrations, whether it was Republican or Democrat, everyone understood that the scientific technological strength of the United States was an engine for economic development, growth, and sustainability. That the United States was always admired worldwide for having the best universities in the world. And that's why the issue about foreign students, of course they want to come to the United States to go to these outstanding universities. For our own people, you know, I've always been dedicated to training as many Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders as I possibly could, because I'm a guy from New York originally. I don't like to admit it in public, but 45 years in the Pacific Islands has taught me this is the place where I'm most comfortable. But it's not me who should be making these decisions. It should be Indigenous people. And if I want to contribute meaningfully, yes, I can provide some science and support, but the biggest benefit I can provide is to being able to develop the scientific skills of the present contemporary science to match with the incredible wealth of Indigenous knowledge, which is outstanding science as well. So over the years, I've mentored, I think I'm up to 87 Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders in my labs that have gone on to incredible positions. You probably know Austin Shelton from Guam. He's now head of their Sea Grant program and their island sustainability. He got his PhD in my lab. Another Chamorro from Saipan, Sean McDuff, is the superintendent for the Marianas Trench National Monument. The minister for the environment for Palau is one of my past graduate students, and they're doing stuff I could never do in my wildest dream. They're not only brilliant scientists and incredibly good Indigenous practitioners, but they're culturally connected. It's not appropriate for me to go to any island to tell people what they should or shouldn't do. Those days are gone. But what I can do is to provide science support and, most importantly, training. And this effort to undercut universities and the brains that are helping to make scientifically informed decisions. I understand my role is not to make decisions, it's to inform the decision-making process. So my responsibility is to provide data that are accurate and adequate to the ways.
And when funding is cut that, you know, allows scientists to do the research and it gets, you know, halted in its tracks, and then the data disappears from the website. I mean, that's got to be hard to watch.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's just outright sinful to see what's going on. I was at a retirement party for one of my good colleagues from, I started working with him in Guam for 18 years. Jerry Davis was the head of the Division of Aquatic Wildlife Resources in Guam. 3 months after I moved back to Hawaii in 2004 to take my position at Kiwalo, he came back and he took over as the assistant administrator for Habitat for NOAA here at the Pacific Island Regional Office. He had to retire or risk losing his benefits. And so at the retirement party, he recognized a lot of his staff. There were like seven of them there. They represented over 150 years of knowledge of the most talented, dedicated, devoted public servants. And that's exactly the way we went into it. Most of my graduate students could easily get a job in the private sector for consulting at 2 to 3 times the salary that they got going into the federal government. But they decided that this was where they really wanted to be. One of my Native Hawaiian students was the chief scientist for conservation for Papanamokuakea, a Native Hawaiian, brilliant, Narissa Spees, outstanding scientist, cultural practitioner. She jumped, was able to bridge both worlds carefully. But what could be better? And that position, she's no longer in it as well. So to see this brain drain and to see the lack of data to make informed decisions is truly a recipe for disaster. My view is this too shall pass, but I think the collateral damage will be so long-lasting, it's going to take decades to rebuild from the losses we're seeing today.
Well, you are heading over on the other side of the globe to attend a UN conference on oceans.
Yeah, it's called the UN Ocean Conference, but there's two elements to it. First week is the science side, so that's where all the geeks and nerds are, so that's my my group. I'll be there talking about ocean health, pollution, and human health. And we call that the One Health model, that ocean health and human health in the Pacific are inextricably linked. And that's the area I'll be talking about, with a particular focus on the Fukushima discharge of 1.3 million tons of radioactively contaminated water into the Pacific, which we know is going to be getting into the food. And it's just the fact of it. So again, I've been working with a lot of leaders, and that's why it's a good target audience. But other members of the coalition for the Pacific Island Heritage Monument, Uncle Sol will be there on the cultural side. Sheila Sarhangi will be there to help coordinate the messaging. But the coalition is a really wonderful group of people, of Indigenous practitioners, of communicators, of scientists, all with the same goal of ensuring that there is a legacy for the future. And again, I say that not just as a scientist, but as a parent. It would be irresponsible for me and my colleagues to watch this go on and not to do everything we possibly could to share information, to work strategically with partners. And that's what we're seeing in the Pacific, which again, I think is a very poor strategic decision coming out of D.C. The Pacific is incredibly important globally in terms of food supply, but also there's a great deal of interest in the political side. And I'm aware of it. It's called, yeah, you know, national security. But the Pacific Islands, if they can't look to the United States for leadership and support on protecting the ocean, which is the culture, the economy, the ecology, they're definitely going to be looking to the West.
Well, you're digging your heels in.
I am. You know, the way I look at it is I describe myself as the optimistic pragmatist. I have to be optimistic to get out of bed in the morning. I have to be pragmatic to do my job. But I'm also a firm believer that persistence beats brilliance 9 times out of 10, and I'm living proof of that.
Well, Bob Richman, thank you for being persistent, and it's great catching up with you.
Thanks so much, Catherine. I appreciate the opportunity.
And that was Bob Richman, director of the Coelho Laboratory, talking to us about the health and future of our oceans. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, this week we heard from Nobel Prize winner Jennifer Doudna about the story of custom treatment for baby KJ, who suffered from a genetic disorder and who is getting help thanks to the CRISPR gene editing, which Doudna helped to develop. The case grabbed headlines at the American Society for Gene Therapy conference last week. And we learned that another Hawaii researcher was there. Assistant Professor Jesse Owens works at the University of Hawaii Biogenesis Institute. He dropped by to talk about the progress that he's making with his gene research, which he also debuted at that conference.
It's the biggest gene therapy conference in the world, and it's this one was in New Orleans, so I made sure I had to go because I love New Orleans. It's one of my favorite cities. And yeah, it's where a lot of these big technologies get unveiled. So this is where they describe for the first time if you invent a new technology or if you have a big discovery, like in this case, where they used an older technology, but they did it in a real person, which was, you know, the big splash.
Right, custom treatment.
That technology is really, it's really interesting. What you do is you go in and you actually change a single base in the genome, you know, just one of those base pairs, and fix the mutation. So it's a very customized and a very specific style of gene therapy. So it was made just for that one person.
And then while that was being unveiled, you were also unveiling something new as well that you've been working on.
Yeah, I've been working on this for about 12 years, and we finally got it to work. So we flew over to New Orleans and presented it. And what we're doing is this thing called targetable transposons. It's kind of a complementary style of gene therapy to the one that was done in the little baby, where the one in the baby, you're going in and you're changing a single base pair. What we're doing is we're actually replacing the entire broken gene. The benefit to that, you know, the way that I describe this to people is, imagine if one person has a car that's broken down, you know, their windshield's broken, and somebody else has got a flat tire. You could go into the windshield place and fix your windshield. You could go into the tire place and fix your tire. But what my therapy does is it just gives you a new car. So it doesn't matter. You can have a broken windshield. You can have a flat tire. It doesn't matter. I don't care. I just give you a new car every time. So you can use one therapy for many different people. And the issue with going in and changing one single mutation is that many people have different mutations. It could be hundreds of different mutations in just one gene. And so you'd have to do hundreds of different therapies, which would be very difficult. It was a big effort to get this therapy through, and it was amazing, and it was a really cool story, but it was difficult, you know. And so kind of the concept with my technology is if we could just figure out a way to replace the whole gene, I don't care what mutation you've got, broken windshield, flat tire, I'll just give you a new gene, new car.
Almost like a shortcut.
Yeah, just replace the whole thing. It's like a shortcut, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talk about then, you know, when you've got this research and you present this, then how does that get applied?
Yeah, that's the hard part. So, you know, there's a lot of really successful labs that have done some amazing stuff. There were 1,600 abstracts at this conference, you know, gene therapy based, which is really amazing. And it's hard because in order for that to end up getting into a person, you usually, with the exception of what just happened, where different researchers and companies kind of came together for this, you know, special case, usually what you need to do is you have to develop a therapy, and that would usually have to go through the FDA, and it's a very difficult process. It always has to go through creating a company, and the company has to raise money, and sometimes from the federal government, sometimes from investors, and it can take many years and many, many millions of dollars. And then only after all of that, then you can start doing clinical trials. Then you see if it's safe, and then it becomes something that you can inject in somebody's arm. I mean, that's a difficult process, and that's what I'm kind of going through right now. Last time we met, we were talking about a different technology, and we spun out a company through from UH called Como And that's what I've been kind of struggling with the last year, was getting that startup off the ground. But it's been fun, and we've got a lot of momentum, and it's going really well. But it's difficult. Yeah.
Well, you know, when we talked to Jennifer Dowd yesterday, and a shout out, she said, you know, go Vikings, because you folks have the same high school, right? Alma mater. But, you know, she was concerned about the climate and that, you know, the funding challenges for folks who are trying to do good basic science.
Yeah, that's the other half of it. So there's most universities, the professors are not trying to do the commercial side of things. But they're usually doing pretty good because they can write grants as long as it's something that's worthwhile. It's funded by the federal government. And that's changing now. And that's pretty scary. You know, if the cuts that are being proposed go through, many of the research institutes are just going to shut down.
And so how are you looking at that? You know, knowing that you're onto something and you need more funding.
Yeah, it's really bad timing because I finally got my stuff to work. It took me many, many years to actually, that was difficult, just getting it to work. And that was a struggle. It's interesting that now that I've got it to work, the funding is drying up, both from the investor side of things. So the startups and the gene therapy world, that's also really not, it's very underfunded right now. And then the federal government side is just a huge mess. And so yeah, it's a big struggle. So when you bring in a grant, let's say you bring in about $1 million, usually you bring in additional funds with that that helps keep the lights on, keeps the university running and stuff like that.
Administrative costs. Right?
Yeah. And those have been dramatically cut. You know, without that money, then it's just so much more difficult to operate. You really need that.
You're just taking it one day at a time. I mean, you know, you've made progress, you're making these steps, but you still ultimately need more funding to get this where it needs to go.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just trying everything. I've written a bunch of grants, waiting for those to come back in. At first, it looked like they weren't even going to read them. And so that was terrifying. Then they did read them. And so, you know, I've gotten some stuff scored. So we might get some money coming in, but that depends on the federal government. So that's the federal side. And then I'm also just doing a lot of fundraising with my startup. And hopefully, it actually kind of seems like a lot of the next big discoveries and the next kind of translation of discoveries to actual therapeutics are going to be funded by big pharma, it seems, because the investors are pulling out. The federal government is very uncertain, but big pharma knows that they still need that. And so I know a lot of people are kind of anti-big pharma, but that's actually what I'm observing is seems to be the guys that are actually paying for this stuff to turn into therapies. And so we're working with several big pharma companies right now to try to get the technologies that I developed at UH into something that could be used for helping people, theoretically.
Yeah. Well, when you think about the times that we're in and the challenges that you're under, I don't know, does it seem daunting?
Well, I'm just happy that my experiments are working. So, I mean, although the funding is more uncertain than ever, the thing that keeps me up at night is when I'm trying to get something to work and it doesn't, you know. And so I'm actually really happy right now. I've got several technologies that we've developed. Each of them have taken at least 4 years of just constant work. I mean, I got a big lab of people working their butts off, and it was a struggle to just get the efficiencies up and get them to be something worthwhile that you could actually present them at the conference. So I'm just really happy that I've got stuff working, and I'm just trying to stay positive, you know.
This week, we saw how Hawaii has joined other states in this lawsuit over the cuts in funding with the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, being cautious.
And the same optimistic. And the same for NIH as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's tiptoeing around eggshells, I guess.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's worrisome. But I mean, at the same time, I've got enough things to worry about. So I'm just trying to focus on, you know, making sure that the technology that we're working on is as specific and safe and efficient as I possibly can. That's my everyday focus.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer had mentioned she has not met this child, KJ, but she did meet a woman who was the first case, I guess, that was treated for sickle cell.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a remarkable moment in time.
That base editing technology is just really amazing. It's an amazing story. It's super efficient, and it's remarkable that you can go in and just change the mutation that's causing the problem to what it should be. It's just amazing.
And I recalled you were working on something with hemophilia at the time, right? Did you get this?
Yeah, my
started?
Grant is for blood clotting disorders. In our paper, we delivered this thing called von Willebrand factor, which is a little like hemophilia. It's a blood clotting disorder, and it's a really big gene. It's so big you can't fit it on a virus, and a lot of gene therapy that people use require viruses. So this was kind of like another option because the viruses couldn't do it. They couldn't deliver such a big gene. So we showed that we can deliver the big gene with our technology. So it was something that set us apart from what was currently being used. That I unveiled at ACCT, American Society of Gene and Cell Therapy, was a completely separate technology. So the lab's kind of split into two. I see two paths for the things that we have developed in the bench to actually turn into something that's valuable for people. One of them is we're looking at ways to try to improve cell line development. And so this is something that's kind of boring and people underappreciate it, but it's the process that we use to make the drugs that we put into people. And the thing is that if you can make that more efficient or faster, then we can lower the cost of the drugs that people take. And so I think it's actually really important. So what COMO does is looks at ways of speeding up and making the biologics, so the actual drugs that would get injected into somebody, easier to make, faster, and cheaper. So there's a lot of bottlenecks there that we're trying to work on. So I think that's a really interesting application, and it's something that is really needed. Like, for example, if we're looking at vaccines, well, and let's say there's another pandemic, it's important to get those vaccines out as fast as possible because the virus can mutate. And that's actually exactly what happened. It took so long for the vaccines to come out originally that they were not as effective when they finally came out. And that was a big problem. So what we're doing is figuring out ways of speeding that up. So if there is another pandemic, we could get your vaccine faster and cheaper to everyone. So that's like one path. The other path is the gene therapy, which is kind of what we're talking about today. How can you replace an entire gene that's broken and not have to go in and do a personalized therapy for each person because it's just so much work? If you could just replace the entire gene, you could have 100 different people with 100 different mutations, but they only take one therapy to get the cure. So we're kind of working on both of those, and we've got some really exciting results right now showing that we can do both of those paths. I've got a grant out right now that's already been scored and actually decided on, but the NIH is so underfunded that they don't even have anybody to tell me whether or not I got it. But that's about a $3.5 million grant that I'll find out any day now, but we're excited about that. That's for the targetable transposon to advance it even further.
Such is the life of a scientist, toiling away in the research lab, looking for clues to unlock medical mysteries and help improve our health and our lives, the promise of future breakthroughs. Owen says it's important that Hawaii continue to support the university and the work that is underway across the state. Wonder where our oil comes from? Well, an energy conference wound up on Maui last week, and the answer to that question was the focus of one of the forums. Why should we care, you might think? Well, consider the global tensions. We used to get oil from Russia, not now. Mark Glick is the head of the state's energy office. He talked to us earlier this morning about just how vulnerable we are. Hawaii is the only state that relies on oil to generate electricity to run its plants, and we pay the highest power rates. Here's Glick with the big takeaway from the meeting of state energy minds last week.
We think it's important to look at the source of our energy coming into Hawaii, you know, where we ship it from, what kind of partners are they. You know, we're basically spending enormous amounts of money to procure these resources, and then we're processing them here. And if they're in the form of oil, that means they're being refined here and then converted into the products we need. We think that people should understand that full life cycle of what's going on, and are we making the best choices about what we're doing?
So where do we get our oil?
So right now we're getting it. It's a mixture of getting it from Libya, getting it from Nigeria, getting it from Argentina. A small portion comes from Alaska. It has dwindling supplies and it's very difficult to get. So the predominant amount, you know, I'd say over the last 10 years, maybe a third came from Libya. Before the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, the predominant amount of oil was coming from Russia. And so we stopped doing that, obviously, after the invasion. And we picked up our imports from Libya and Argentina and Nigeria since then.
So why does that matter, where we get our oil?
Well, again, you know, we're trying to be energy self-sufficient as much as we can. Now, we know from our studies that we use so much energy and we're land constrained, so we can't produce everything that we want, but we've been trying through our renewable energy policies and our decarbonization policies to produce as much as we can here from renewable resources and also to take into consideration carbon, because we've committed to be fully decarbonized by 2045. So looking at where this energy comes from really contributes to all of those things, the affordability as well as the impact on the environment.
And what's the issue with Libya?
Well, Libya, again, this is not, you know, a political statement or anything. It's a matter of where it sits in Africa. It has different policies in terms of how it develops and stores and moves energy. So we have graphic images of open pools of crude oil because they produce so much crude oil. It sits on the ground. It evaporates in the hot Libyan heat. And they also have so much pressure from that in excess that all of the associated gases are flared. Much of it is open flares. And these flares go off for weeks at a time and spew black smoke that represents benzenes and toluenes and propanes and as well as natural gas and other things from pulling crude oil from the ground. So it has an enormous negative impact on the environment that, again, I don't think it's something that we should just simply ignore as we're looking at alternatives.
And so where do we go from here? I mean, you mentioned that we have, very high power bills and that we make that energy off of aging plants.
That's right. One of the things that we did learn from our recent alternative fuels repowering and energy transition study that the Energy Office released in January was that we're going to continue to import fuels, and that if we continue to move forward on the current integrated grid plan, that a significant amount will continue to rely on liquid oil-based fossil fuels, such as low-sulfur fuel oil or ultra-low-sulfur diesel. We're really at the administration level. We're finding that unacceptable. We believe that when you have alternatives that may be hemispheric, from North America or from the mainland U.S. in the form of something like natural gas or ultimately in the form of ammonia, green ammonia or green hydrogen, or locally produced biofuels to the extent that we can produce them. Those can be done at an improved cost to what we're currently doing and at a really extraordinarily less carbon impact.
So we've got to do better.
Yeah, we've got to do better, and we do have the options to do better. We just have chosen to table those options, and I think a policy decision was made in 2015 to just stick with going directly from oil to renewables. And what we've learned from these analyses is that leaves on, even if we move as rapidly as we can to renewables, it will leave us burning low-sulfur fuel oil and diesel for the next 15 to 20 years in significant amounts.
So we're vulnerable.
That's right. We're vulnerable to oil price volatility, which really wreaks havoc on the economy. And it's just, obviously it's really risky because it's coming from these different parts of the world. We just learned 2 days ago that there's an internal discord within Libya that may cut off the fields that we're currently getting oil from, and that means higher prices. So, because we'll have to get it from somewhere else, and we source it from there because that's where it's available, and that's where the price has been acceptable.
Yikes. I mean, that's not good news.
No. So we are concerned about those. We're on top of those things, and again, we spent the last year looking at all of the alternatives. We have found some solutions that make sense. We'd need to act on them sooner than later because the timing is in our favor. We want to be completely out of any kind of fossil fuel by 2045. So if we bring and we have to make some shifts because we have to build some infrastructure, we want to be able to pay off all that infrastructure by 2045.
The administration has talked about rethinking the position on liquefied natural gas. I know that, folks are hopeful about hydrogen. But
right.
It's got to be, clean hydrogen and cost efficient to make. And then there's always, geothermal. We've been turning that stone over for a very long time.
Yeah, you're so right. We have to do all of those things. We need to be very open-minded about, you know, doing something that will be a lot more affordable and that will continue to move us in the right direction, you know, of reducing our carbon intensity and moving us in a way that will not impede our progress on renewables. And we're fully committed to that at the administration and at the State Energy Office. But we do believe there are alternatives to what we're doing that make a lot more sense than what we're doing.
That was Mark Glick, CEO of the Hawaii State Energy Office, underscoring the fragility of our energy reserves and the sense of urgency to do more to diversify our energy portfolio.
Aloha mai kākou. Hawaii is rich with mele, mo'olelo, and ike kupuna. I'm Mileka Lincoln, and the Hawaii Radio Hour brings all of this from Kahilu Theater here in Waimea. On Sunday, we'll have a mo'olelo story about an O'ahu girl falling in love with a country boy. This cowboy can't see himself living anywhere other than Hawaii Island, so what's a city girl to do? Find out on this week's episode.
Premiering Sunday at 4 on HPR 1.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported in part by local organizations that choose to reinforce their brand with us. Mahalo to Dr. Carlos Omfroy, MD, Pineapple Tweed, and Aloha United Way. They believe, as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our sponsors at hawaiipublicradio.org.
You know, earlier this month, we highlighted efforts to control the invasive black wattle tree from Australia because its wood burns slowly, and that raises the fire risk to nearby communities. Well, today, HPR's reporter Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel joins us to talk about that and other fire prevention efforts in Kula. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was really intrigued about that black wattle tree because I didn't know much about it.
Yes. So I believe last week you talked to Colleen Uechi of the Hawaii Journalism Initiative about that. And so I don't want to repeat too much information, but there's been a ton of community-led organizations and efforts happening in Kula, you know, since the 2023 wildfires, but certainly gearing up this year for the upcoming fire season. You know, they've experienced back-to-back summer fires in 2023, of course, and that burned 20 homes, you know, and thousands of acres. And then again, a large wildfire last summer. So people are really motivated to get out there and do whatever they can. One of those organizations that you heard about last week was the Kula Community Watershed Alliance. And as you mentioned, they've been working on their Wipe Out Wattle initiative. Wattle is an invasive tree, and it actually thrives on fire. As you mentioned, it's from Australia, and fire actually triggers it's seed germination, and so it's part of its, like, sort of natural cycle. And when you cut it down, it grows even more shoots. So it's really tough to control. And the Alliance got grant funding to help clear the steep gulches in Kula with a trained team. So they're doing that now. Sarah Tekula is executive director of the Watershed Alliance. And she talked about the importance of really a holistic approach to conservation and controlling this wattle, not just for fire, but, you know, taking into consideration a lot of other things. Sarah Tekula talked about a little native mammal, Hawaii's only land mammal, that is also impacted by their work. And I thought it was really cool. Here she talks about it.
It feels really good for the funding to come online kind of at this time because we're trying to get everything cut before they start to produce seeds, but also before we get to a really important season, which is the Opeapea pupping season, our endangered bat. A lot of Kula residents love watching the bats. You know, they circle around at sunset, and it's just, they're magical. Well, between June 1st and September 15th, They are in pupping season, and it's generally best practice, especially in conservation organizations, to not cut trees taller than 15 feet tall during that time, because that's when bats are leaving their cute little bat pups in the trees while they go hunt and come back. And if you cut the tree down, you've taken out at least two. Usually they have twins, at least two of our endangered bats, right? So kind of race against time, both with the pupping season and with fire season.
Wow. I mean, who knew, right? Hoary bats in those black nettle trees.
Yeah, so much to take into consideration when doing this type of work. Another organization is the Kula Community Association, and they wrote a letter to the governor and state officials requesting help for the community. Multiple community leaders have told me that when the power goes out in Kula, there's no water because the water has to be pumped uphill and the pumps rely on electricity, right? And so, you know, in 2023, people experienced trying to fight the fire with their garden hoses and turning them on in their backyards and having no water. And they, you know, didn't have drinking water in many areas for weeks because of contamination in the line. So that's really a big concern for people. And so the Kula Community Association is asking for two 500,000 gallon tanks. And I asked the county, like, don't you have backup generators? And they said they do. But it's not quite clear when they were installed. And they say they're at critical locations. You know, it just doesn't seem to be real clear. They said they're huge, the size of semi-trucks, and they are getting in the process of getting two dozen more generators with federal assistance. But, you know, residents are saying that that's, you know, it's still a really big concern. Jordan Hawker is board president of the Kula Community Association and says they're requesting these 500,000-gallon tanks to be installed in Kula for emergencies.
I would say our two main areas of need are the 500,000-gallon water tanks that are placed at an area with enough elevation that that could stand in as a firefighting or potable water system. In the case that we lose that, that's one of our major asks, because there is just there's no solution to that. And then that the state, DLNR, and various agencies collaborate with the county to manage those state lands that are currently unmanaged and overgrown. From our perspective, it's hard not to see the state's acquisition of land and then subsequently not managing it as a huge part of our fire regime. Because when you think about it, if say you have 2,500 acres that gets pulled into quote unquote conservation, right? But it's not managed and the invasive species haven't been taken care of. But before it was managed through agriculture or ranching, it's hard to say that that transition over the last 30 years hasn't significantly increased our fire risk.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so there's over 10,000 acres that they've identified that is state owned or managed. And so, you know, they're asking for, you know, better management of those invasive species that we talked about, you know, growing that are increasing the fire risk. And Hawker says, you know, they're hopeful based on the responses that they've received so far that there will be, you know, continued action on that. Another organization that's been very proactive in Kula is called Malama Kula. They were founded from community efforts, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the wildfires in 2023. One of their initiatives has been to provide green waste bins for residents in Kula. You know, previously many people dumped their green waste in the gulches, which ended up sort of fueling the fires. And the closest sort of legal option is the Central Maui Landfill, which is almost an hour away from many people in upcountry Maui. And so that's one of the things that they've done to help the community. Executive Director Kyle Ellison talks about the other things they've been doing lately.
We're still sitting ducks up here in Kula when it comes to fire risk, that's for sure. But a lot of people are rowing in the right direction. There's definitely been a lot of progress, but it's an enormous project where by no means are we out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, we've got hundreds of acres, thousands of acres in Kula that are at risk. And I mean, even if we do, you know, 10 to 12 acres, which is a lot, it's just a drop in the bucket in terms of what needs doing. I mean, even as I talk right now, we're prioritizing cutting fire breaks around homes. And there was a new Maui County fire code that was adopted in December that is much stricter. You know, like right now, if anything's over 9 feet tall, it can't be within 100 feet of a neighboring structure on a neighboring property. And there are a lot of places like that. So we're currently today working on a place like that where we're helping cut fire breaks around homes. Because we did see in the fire in 2023 up here in Kula that you just need a little bit of defensible space, or just having that fire break area can make the difference between your home surviving and not. So we are making progress on things like that, on cutting fire breaks around homes and really trying to remove a lot of the wattle that's regrowing and the invasive species that are literally fueling the fires.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, yeah, feeling like sitting ducks because you don't want to see another devastating wildfire like we saw hit Maui.
Absolutely. And, you know, like we talked about earlier, you know, Kula is really steep topography. You know, it's these deep gulches where the fires just travel down and ignite, you know, really quickly. It's hard to access it. You know, they were fighting the fire for months after August 2023. And so, you know, it is a really big concern. A lot of those invasives fueling the fires, and, you know, it's great to see people really taking the initiative to protect their communities in different ways.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking with HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel, about ongoing efforts in Kula to prepare for the upcoming fire season. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to hear from Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke about cuts to broadband programs. What's on your mind? Call our talkback line, leave us your comments, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our producing team includes Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital Team. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.